Last month, the Basque separatist group ETA announced that it would abandon its 40-year-long armed struggle for independence of the Basque region. This group has been blamed for the deaths of more than 800 people and has been officially labeled a terrorist organization by the governments of Spain, also by the EU and the United States. In a statement that had been given out to the media, the Basque media, ETA said that it now would work to promote a democratic process in the Basque country. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking a bit about Spanish politics and some of the long-running tensions in the northern Basque region. And our guest for this hour of the program is Stanley Payne. He is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. He is the author of 15 books, most of them dealing with modern Spanish history. Most recent, just to name a couple of titles, The Spanish Civil War, The Soviet Union and Communism, published by Yale in 2004, and another book forthcoming from Yale, The Collapse of the Spanish Republic, Origins of the Civil War, 1933 to 1936. He is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's for the local callers here. We do also have that toll-free line. And that would mean that if it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, and actually anyone listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Payne, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Well, perhaps first, for people who perhaps just don't follow Spanish politics very closely, we should talk about ETA. This is a group that has been around for a while, was founded in 1959. Initially was not associated with violence, but certainly has been in recent years, although it's been several years since there's been a violent action by ETA. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about, first of all, what is ETA and what are its goals?
Well, let's back up a bit and start with the Basque Nationalist Movement. Mm-hmm. The Basque Nationalist Movement was started over 100 years ago in the 1890s. And its main carrier has been an organization called simply the Basque Nationalist Party, the PNV, an acronym in Spanish. This organization, the terrorist organization, was founded, as you say, in 1959 at a very low point in the history of Basque nationalism because in the middle of the Franco regime, most Basque nationalists had pretty much given up. The area was very prosperous economically, one of the most favored parts of Spain in financial and economic terms, but also repressed politically, and nationalists simply were not active. And so some of the young people in the movement organized this new organization to take a more militant stand and turn to violence 9 years later in 1968 when they carried out their first killing. The name is an acronym, ETA, which stands for Euskadita Askatasuna, meaning Basque Land and Liberty. Began, in fact, more and more as a kind of a Marxist-Leninist organization, sort of a national socialist movement. This, of course, leads some Spaniards to say that ETA is a Nazi movement. Its heyday probably was in the 1970s and 80s, became more active with the democratization of Spain because democracy gave it more freedom of action. It could carry out more acts. It has functioned both as a straight terrorist organization, but more commonly its violence has been what one would call targeted killings. That is, most of its victims have been policemen and army officers, not random terrorism of the jihadi kind that one sees from the Middle East. The preceding conservative government really tried very hard to put the screws on reduced ETA activity considerably by 2004. It was at its lowest point. The present government, the socialist government of José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, has followed a different tack of trying a political relationship, and this has produced now the present truce, which has not resulted in the disarming of the movement or the handing over of its weapons, but now has committed it to a political phase.
Mm-hmm. The Basque country is in, it's a relatively small, as I look at the map of the various communities in Spain, the various areas of Spain, it's not a very big area. It's in the northern part of Spain. It adjoins, it's in that part of Spain that adjoins France. In what way are the Basques different from the other people of Spain?
That's a good question. As a general anthropological type of society, there probably is not that much difference. They at one time had their own language, which they're trying to revive, and the Basque language of the several languages of the Iberian Peninsula is the only non-Romance language. It is some kind of autochthonous pre-Indo-European language, which linguists, in fact, have not been able to relate directly to just about any other known language. Mm. But, of course, most Basque people don't really know Basque until the revival of the present time, so that the modern language of the Basque country has been Spanish. But like the several regions of Spain, they have their own culture. They have folk music. They have a variety of habits and customs. And what really kicked off nationalism was the industrialization, the modernization of the Basque country, because in modern times, the Basque country has been the most heavily industrialized part of Spain. It is the main home, for example, of heavy industry. And basically two things happened in the 19th century to encourage a nationalist movement. One was the relative centralization and modernization of Spanish government. Spain, at one time, was composed of a variety of different kingdoms brought together under the central monarchy with their own laws. The Basque provinces, particularly since the 15th century, had their own laws and regulations, which they called fueros, F-U-E-R-O-S, fueros. And most, to some extent, these were lost in the 19th century as the government became more centralized. There were two civil wars in the 19th century, wars really between traditionalism and modern liberalism. The Basques remained on the side of traditionalism to maintain their traditional institutions. They lost. So that was, of course, a very negative background for them. And then right after that came the beginning of modern industrialization. And for the first time in Basque history, at least in knowable Basque history, the large-scale immigration of non-Basques into the Basque country. And it was the nativist reaction against non-Basques that really helped kick off the nationalist movement in the 1890s. This then required a movement to try to begin to restore the language, which, until the Basque country became autonomous with the present democracy, really made no headway. Basque lost more and more. But then with the language laws, which try to impose the Basque language, the language has been coming back to some extent, particularly among the young people, although the preferred language in the Basque country still remains Spanish. So the basic language of the Basque country still is Spanish.
Well, how do people think of themselves as Basque, or do they think of themselves as Spanish, or as some combination of those two things?
All different ways. Hmm. The Basque population, that is the people who live in the Basque country, at least a third of whom are not of Basque origin, are politically considerably divided and have all kinds of different positions on this issue. What normally happens is that the nationalist parties, for the elections to the Basque government and parliament, the autonomous Basque government and parliament, usually get themselves together and carry the day with some kind of majority for a nationalist policy. And in the standards of political correctness that prevail, they always present themselves as victims, so that sometimes it's not easy to combat them. Sometimes the socialists in the Basque country go along with them, sometimes not. But in fact, there is a good deal of division, and a significant part of the Basque population does not support the radical nationalist program. So that when the question is asked the Spanish government, why don't you let the Basques just do what they want, they say, well, there are different kinds of Basques. And the Basques who don't support radical nationalism are the victims of various kinds of repressive and exclusionary laws and practices, and we can't simply abandon them to anti-democratic practices. Quite aside from, of course, the basic patriotic and political issue of the question of Spanish identity, Spanish unity, maintaining the integrity of Spain, etc., etc., etc. So the Basque population is very divided. And one of the great mistakes made by foreign journalists is to talk about the Basques. In terms of politics, there is no such thing as the Basques because there are all different kinds of Basque positions. But generally, the radical nationalists managed to mobilize at least a kind of majority in support of their proposals, and this carries them on politically, although the sector that directly supports the terrorists has never been larger, as far as the public opinion polls indicate, than somewhere around 15%.
So that gets at one of the questions that I certainly had in mind asking was that given that on the one hand there could be strong support for the idea of Basque autonomy, if not independence, that the level of support for ETA and violence as a means of gaining those ends would always have been, it sounds like it would always have been relatively small.
The direct support for ETA has been small. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the nationalist parties, who get 50% or more of the vote, have had a rather ambiguous position with this. One of the books about them calls it the tree and the nuts. That is, the shaking of the tree brings down the nuts. The main nationalist parties don't support violence and the violent shaking of the tree, but they like to harvest the nuts as they fall to the ground if they can gain political concessions through this. So there's always been a kind of ambiguity, even though the main nationalist parties have never directly endorsed violence.
There is ETA has a political wing. It's called Haribatasuna. This is something that I guess I have always thought in my mind, maybe with something like the situation in Ireland and involving the IRA and Sinn Féin, its political wing that eventually did become involved in more mainstream politics in Northern Ireland. Is that an appropriate kind of comparison to make between ETA and Haribatasuna?
I think that's probably a good comparison. Haribatasuna is not as old as ETA, but as the democratic system developed, the extremely radical nationalists, the terrorist nationalists, realized that they needed a political arm, and they considered the two main Basque nationalist parties as insufficiently vehement and militantly radical. Hence, Haribatasuna, which some years ago was simply declared by the Spanish legal system outlawed as a political organization that supported and helped to practice terrorism, and probably is now going to be brought back and re-legalized under the present political deal that Zapatero is trying to pull off.
We have a caller here to talk with, a couple. We'll get right to in a moment. I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Stanley Payne. He is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and is particularly interested in the history of modern Spain, Italy, and Portugal. And we're talking about Spain and Spanish politics, and particularly some about the Basque separatist group ETA, which last month announced that after decades of armed struggle that it was going to have a ceasefire, and it was going to get away from armed struggle as a way of achieving Basque independence and move towards a political solution. Something that, though, I gather there have been ceasefires before that didn't last. So perhaps, Professor Payne, is there some question about whether or not this is going to be a permanent situation?
Oh, of course, there's always a question mark here. There was a ceasefire, for example, in the 1990s that lasted nearly 2 years, I believe. So it's happened before. And cynical people will say, well, of course, ETA also simply had lost support, was much weaker by 2004 than it had been in a long time, and it simply needs a breathing space in order to regroup. So one gets that opinion also in Spain at the present.
We'll talk here first with a caller in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. If this question is germane, good. If it's not, the way it goes. Where does France and Portugal fit into this picture, if at all?
Well, Portugal does not fit in because Portugal is a smaller country, and the Portuguese, when offered the opportunity several years ago by referendum to have a system of regional autonomy in their own country, simply rejected the idea, saying that Portugal is a small democratic country. It's not of the size that needs separate autonomous regions. The different regions can get together with their government. It's just not big enough and doesn't need that sort of thing. So the Portuguese are out of the game. Now, the Basque population exists on both sides of the Franco-Spanish Pyrenean border. The French Basque Country, as it's normally called, is made up of three small departments, which are even smaller than the provinces on the Spanish side, and involve even less population, and are primarily more or less rural, and don't have the same degree of urban or industrial concentration at all. So the French Basque Country is really quite different. It's smaller, it's less developed economically, it's less important. Basque nationalists have always wanted to create a Basque country in political terms that has never existed in history. There's never been a Basque state. There's never been any kind of unified Basque country. There have always been simply individual units in Spain, individual units on the other side of the border as well. So the program of Basque nationalists has always been to create a what they call a unified Basque country, a kind of a new invention. But they've never pushed the French part too much, simply because the French state is more centralized and more vigorous than the Spanish state, and they don't have as much support on the French side. So although there has been militant activity on the French side as well, it's never been as extensive, and it's never been as important, and it's never gotten as far. And the main Basque nationalist parties at the same time realize that you fight one war at a time. They can't take on France at the same time they take on Spain. So French Basqueness is certainly there as a political issue in the background. It has at times been militant in the past, though not at all to the degree it's in Spain. But it is, for Basque nationalists in Spain at the present time, a secondary issue that remains very much in the background. Well, they have all they can do trying to break up Spain. They can't really take on breaking up France as well.
We just, again, I want to make, I guess people should understand that Spain is divided into a number of regions, and the Basque Country is one of them. They all have their own elected regional assemblies, regional governments, and that different areas, their relationship to the central government is different, so that some areas have greater autonomy than others. What exactly is the relationship between the government of the locally, regionally elected government in the Basque Country and the central government of Spain?
Well, the relations are political, economic, administrative. In other words, they are somewhat analogous to the relationship between the government of the state of Illinois and Washington, D.C. The idea of federalism itself didn't have too much support in Spain, because there was a federal republic in 1873 which was totally chaotic and simply broke apart altogether. And the idea has been that federalism is too strong for Spain, but Spain has very specific regional identities and also has several regional languages. So when the country was democratized after the death of Franco in 1975, the concept used by the leaders of the New Democratic Spain was to try to follow the Italian example. With the democratization of Italy and the conversion of Italy into a republic after the Second World War, the Italian government simply recognized six special regions: the island of Sicily, the island of Sardinia, several regions in the northwest and northeast, six special regions which, because of their location, their geography, their history, their culture, had a particular kind of identity which they judged merited autonomy and a special recognition, while organizing most of Italy under one single central administrative system. Now, to some extent, that has changed in recent years. When the socialists finally came into the government in the late 20th century, they also introduced a greater degree of regional autonomy for Italy as a whole. But this original Italian system was what the Spanish leaders wanted to follow in 1976-77 in creating the special Spanish constitution. They believed that the Catalonia, which was the region with a history of autonomy, the strongest political movement, the Basque country, and then also Galicia, which has a separate language of its own, akin to Portuguese, in the northwest, would be the three regions in Spain, analogous to the regions in Italy, that would merit special autonomy. And the idea was to give them special statutes of autonomy, as had been in the process of being worked out under the Democratic Second Republic in the 1930s before the Civil War. This was the original idea. But then came the demonstration effect, of course, of three special regions being set up for autonomy, and then all the other regions of Spain said, well, how are we unequal or inferior? We want autonomy as well. And yet, the autonomy worked out particularly for Catalonia and for the Basque Country was based on certain kinds of historical precedents in laws and regulations. And in fact, the Catalan and Basque nationalists both insisted on a very special kind of treatment. They did not want mere autonomy, but certain kinds of particular things which they said reflected their history and were rights that had once been exercised in their history. And so the system that eventually developed in Spain by the early 1980s, as the full democratic system worked out, is a system of very hard to give an exact label to, because it's not like the American or the German or the Swiss system, where essentially all the component units have equal rights under the Constitution. It's asymmetrical. It's a system of asymmetrical autonomies or asymmetrical federalism or quasi-federalism in which Catalonia and the Basque Country have a more complete, more advanced, more privileged status of autonomy than do the other autonomous regions. So that you have several different models of autonomy in Spain. The question has been raised then by some Spaniards, why can't we simply have an organized model in which everyone can be equal and everyone can be equally autonomous? Very good question. Very hard to answer. But the asymmetry continues, and what the Catalans and the Basques have been demanding now in recent years, Catalans have gotten with the revised Catalan statute, was just approved at the beginning of this spring by the Spanish government, is a system of yet more advanced autonomy, yet more complete control of Catalonia, in which the Catalan government also has enormous centralized powers over Catalonia. More than most other regional governments have in Spain. So the asymmetry continues. Well, what do they really want in the case of the Basque? What they want, of course, is a situation of a kind of de facto independence, which will be made palatable to the government, the population, the rest of Spain, by being papered over by the continuing of a political relationship between the Basque Country and the Spanish state.
Well, this I'm glad you brought up the issue of the Catalan situation and this here, these events that took place right at, I believe, at the end of March when the parliament, the Spanish parliament, approved this plan to give greater greater autonomy to Catalonia. Then you wonder, well, what about the other regions in the country? How many other places are going to look at what's happening there and what's happening in the Basque Country and say, well, if they got it, then we should too. I mean, what does that really mean for the country as a whole?
Very good question. And we already see, for example, that certain other regions said, well, if the Catalans are getting a new statute with more autonomy and more privileges, we want a new statute with more autonomy and more privilege. So it's the same process as took place 25 years ago after the death of Franco, now being repeated all over again at a higher level, demanding even a greater degree of autonomy and further reduced powers for the central government. So this begins a whole new cycle. The catch always is that the Catalans and the Basques demand more. They don't want simply a system of broad devolution of autonomy and self-government for everybody, because they insist on what the Catalans call the fet diferencial, the differential fact or reality of Catalonia and its history and institutions, so they must always be more different. It's always a question of Catalans and Basques being more different yet and having special institutions and more of the same, but the demonstration effect is natural and inevitable, so the other regions also want to have something more and more approximating what the Catalans and the Basques have, and so you have a whole new spiral of these demands now underway, with the Prime Minister of Spain, Rodríguez Zapatero, acting as the ringmaster. He seems to have confidence that he can manipulate all this stuff and somehow pull it off. What's behind it from his point of view, why he has encouraged it in the case of the Catalans and the Basques, is because he thinks he can make a long-term deal between the Socialist Party on the Spanish national level and the main Catalan and Basque nationalist parties. That is, the Socialist Party does not have a natural majority. It was hurtled into power by the trauma of the Moroccan terrorist attack in 2004, when, according to all the polls, it was losing the elections. It doesn't have an absolute majority in the present parliament. It doesn't have a natural majority necessarily in Spanish society. And Zapatero's idea is that he can make a deal between the socialists and the Basque and Catalan nationalists that will create a kind of firm entente for an absolute majority for a long time in the future. This, however, as is suggested by various Spanish political commentators, may be quite a vociferous basis for a long-term governing majority in Spain.
We are just a little bit past our midpoint. Just very quickly, I'll introduce again the guest, Stanley Payne. He's professor of history at University of Wisconsin-Madison and has written a lot about the histories of modern Spain, Portugal, and Italy. And we're talking about Spain and Spanish politics. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Whichever one works for you. Callers are certainly welcome to call in with questions and comments. You talked about the victory in 2004, March 2004, of the Socialist Workers' Party and Mr. Zapatero, who is now the prime minister. He unseated the previous government, was led by José María Aznar. And there, I think that a lot of sort of the conventional explanation of what happened here did indeed have to, was related to the Madrid bombing. And ultimately, it was the Spanish people punishing Mr. Aznar for having supported the United States and President Bush in Iraq. Is there more to it than that? I mean, was this really more about internal Spanish politics than it was that that the connection between the Spanish government, the American government, involving Iraq?
No, well, it was about internal Spanish politics in the sense that the socialists had been doing everything they possibly could to make this an electoral issue against the government. But in fact, it was the issue of the war and then the nature of the terrorist attack, and also a certain fumbling by the conservative government of Aznar right after the terrorist attack, because it wasn't clear who the authors of the attack were. And they were convinced, as the socialists, in fact, were convinced at the moment of the attack, that Spain was not going to be the target of Islamist jihadis, that Spain had a kind of special relationship with the Islamic world, unlike the situation, let's say, even with France or Italy, much less North European countries. And although that Spain might be a staging area for jihadi terrorists, since the Spanish authorities knew that, in fact, even some of the 9/11 terrorists had some organizational activity in Spain. Spain might be a staging ground, something like that, a base area. It would not be a target, despite the fact that the Spanish government had not participated in the invasion of Iraq, but had played a supporting role in that and had provided some then supporting Spanish troops, but was not really involved in military activities. So the Conservative Party government really fumbled the ball at first, insisting this must be the work of Basque terrorists. And as soon as the information began to come out in the 3 days between the terrorist attack and the elections, that in fact it might be Islamic jihadis, the socialists seized on this and played it up with a series of demonstrations, which technically were illegal under Spanish law, because the day before elections is supposed to be a day of non-political activity. It's called a day of reflection. The socialists instead used this to mount a series of demonstrations in all the larger Spanish cities against the government, and this worked very well. So obviously an element of domestic politics, but it really had a good deal to do with foreign policy and terrorism and the way in which the government fumbled the ball right after the terrorist attack itself took place in those 72 hours before the elections.
Let's talk with another caller here, someone listening here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, it seems to me that there was already a fair amount of suspicion, contrary to what you just said about the fact that Spain could have been a target. There was this Norwegian document that had been translated, and I believe that was already somewhat circulating in circles. It wasn't widely discussed, but it was supposedly a Al-Qaeda strategy document that suggested that Spain would be susceptible. And this fumbling that you're talking about is basically the idea of trying to immediately blame it on ETA. I don't know. And it just seems like the polls were actually a bit more volatile than I thought you let on, too, that there were some polls that said that it was going to be the left coalition was going to have a marginal victory.
Not the general substance of the polls, but the best reading one get out of the polls would be that the PP, the Conservative Party, would lose its absolute majority, but would still win some kind of victory. This is the main conclusions of the polls. Now, to go back to your points, these are interesting points, and they raise some interesting questions. Why were the Spanish authorities not more on their toes? Why did they have such self-confidence? It has since come out that, in fact, the majority of the Moroccans who were involved in the terrorist attack had already been identified by the Spanish police. And many of them had petty criminal records involved in the drug trade, various kinds of things like that, which Spanish prosecution is relatively lenient on in some ways. But the Spanish authorities, the police, were convinced that these people were not really dangerous. And, of course, even to the extent that some of them had jihadi contacts, there's always the idea on the part of police intelligence authorities that you don't want to arrest these people prematurely, because if there is something serious going on, they will lead you to the bigger fish, that kind of thing. So though there were warning signs, they were very badly misread by the police themselves. And in fact, it came out right after the terrorist attack that on the 1st of January, the Ministry of the Interior had reduced by 50% the police personnel that had been dedicated to watching Islamic terrorist activities in Spain. The idea that this really was not that much of a problem, and they were assigned to ETA again for fear that ETA would destabilize the elections, which were coming up in 2.5 months. So some very fundamental mistakes and fundamental misreading by people in the government and by the Spanish police. In fact, we have the documentation on the police reports and the initial police reports, particularly the first 36 hours after the terrorist attack, given by the police themselves to the government, whether this seemed to be an ETA operation. Nonetheless, they were slow in responding to new evidence that came along within 36 hours that, in fact, this probably was an Islamic operation. And although there is a willingness to believe that ETA is capable of anything, and probably is, in fact, ETA activities, as I'd mentioned earlier, normally were targeted killings. There had only been a limited number of outright terrorist activities. Of course, the initial response by the Basque government in Vitoria, the Basque country, was simply to announce this is by far the worst thing, the most inhuman act ever done by ETA. That is, initially, the Basque government was also convinced that this was a kind of act of super terrorism by ETA, without, of course, having any particular police reports as to the actual source and office of the attack.
And the Al-Qaeda cell went up in an explosion upon capture, so there's no possibility, whether that's remote or not, of actually getting any... There were arguments that ETA had colluded with Al-Qaeda, which I don't think were particularly founded in anything, but there's no way to actually trace some of that back, because a lot of the cell was blown up upon, just before apprehension, if I recall.
Yeah, that's right. The main survivor group in Leganés, in the suburb in the far south end of Madrid, simply exploded themselves. The only data here is there have been contacts between ETAs in jail and Islamists in jail in Spain. But there's no evidence, that there has been any significant planning. There are still loose ends in the investigation. And all the I's and T's have not been dotted and crossed in the investigation still, but there is no concrete evidence that points to a direct ETA connection in the jihadi attack, which was done basically by Moroccans, and particularly Moroccans from the old Spanish protectorate in northern Morocco, from around Tetouan. This was not even what you would call, I guess, a central al-Qaeda operation. It was really done by these Moroccan affiliates. So there was also even an element of autonomy in the terrorist attack that was planned and carried out.
Which also makes you think that there might have been something in the particular Spanish-Morocco Polisario. In other words, a more particular Spanish-Moroccan grievance involved as well.
Well, you can generalize that, of course, to the grievances of young male Muslims living in Western Europe, the sort of thing you see in France, and then the terrorist attacks in Britain, which were done by British Pakistanis.
I'm saying that's the easy reductionist sort of analysis to make. But what I'm saying is there's a more particular thing going on as well, and I think it's important to emphasize those, at least to point them out, because it sort of gets away from just a simple Huntington-style clash of civilizations argument. That's what I was getting at. The Basque were known for being traitors in the rising of the Spanish Empire around the world, and I'm wondering how that. I mean, it was also a poorer area in the north of Spain, so there obviously was a very strong class division inside the Basques themselves. And I'm just wondering if there's any way you can speculate on what effect that might have had about the whole independent movement and the tendency for some of the Basques to want to stay with the rest of Spain.
Well, the social division inside the Basque country retarded the development of nationalism because the socialists and communists were also strongly organized in the early 20th century in the Basque country, and they normally did not support nationalism. So that, for example, in the early 20th century, political opinion of the Basque country was triangulated, basically between nationalists, the potentially revolutionary left, which was made up of blue-collar workers, and the conservatives, who tend to be what the Spanish call españolista, that is generally Spanish-identified. So these social divisions, which were very typical of an industrializing region in early 20th century Europe, the classic era of class struggle, tended to militate against nationalism and hold the nationalist movement back. And in fact, nationalism then became stronger in the late 20th century as the Basque country began to enter what people would call a post-industrial phase, when these social divisions were no longer so strong, when there was a kind of a broader kind of middle-class ethos generally that the nationalists could play to. And so they finally were able, by the late 20th century under the present democracy, to use nationalism as a way of transcending social differences. But they could do that because the social differences simply were much less in the late 20th century than in the first part of the period when they had been so sharp and so conflictive.
Hmm. It's just been a little over 2 years since the bombings took place. A number of people have been arrested and are being held and have been held for a long time in connection with this. Is there any word on when there might likely be a trial?
They now are proceeding with the prosecution of, I've forgotten the exact number, I think it's something like 27 people. Now, of these 27 people, a very large minority are Spaniards. Mm-hmm. But these seem to be Spaniards who were simply accomplices, and perhaps not entirely knowing accomplices, criminal accomplices, but not political accomplices. It proceeds very slowly, and there is considerable criticism of that.
Let us talk with another caller. This is someone listening in Charleston, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions. I've had the opportunity to teach in Spain on various occasions in the early 80s, and visited recently several times when my daughter was studying in Spain. And I was just amazed at the changes that had taken place. In the early 80s, there was still a lot of Franco sympathy, unlike what a lot of people in the United States felt, especially taxi cab drivers and those kind of people felt much more secure under the Franco administration. There was kind of a saying at that time that a woman could walk down Main Street at, or in a remote area at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and be perfectly safe. So my question has to do with security in the Guardia Civil. They were, as you know, very much feared during the Franco administration. Some people might have even compared them to the SS. But what type of presence do they have in the Basque province today? When I was in Spain, I told my students, do not approach a Guardia Civil as an information officer. They are there especially to guard government buildings. And I was wondering, do they have a strong presence in the Basque province? And the second question is, some of the reading that I have done on the Internet, particularly in the New York Times, have talked about a fragmentation of Spain in the future. I am delighted to hear that the Basques, at least for now, have decided to lay down their arms. Could you speak to those two questions, please? The presence of the Guardia Civil in the Basque region, that I call a province, by the way, and also the possible fragmentation of Spain in the future. Thank you.
All right. Thank
I'll
you.
Put down the phone and listen on the radio.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Well, police functions in the country have also been increasingly autonomized. So the government of the Basque country in Vitoria has its own police force, the Ertzaintza, which is responsible for most police functions now in the Basque country. So that also has been made subject to autonomization. Nonetheless, in terms of ultimate authority, even though ordinary police functions are not carried out by what you would call Spanish authorities in the Basque country now, in terms of ultimate security, the military and so forth, the Basque country is obviously part of the general Spanish security system. As to what's going to happen, no one knows in terms of maintaining the identity of the country. The Prime Minister, Zapatero, insists that there is no danger to the ultimate unity of Spain, that this is simply a reform, which will be carried out democratically and will make everybody happier, and everything will be all right. Well, we'll see. There is some skepticism, although the initial response of public opinion has been positive because, of course, Spanish people are very, very tired of living with terrorism, and they want to see it come to an end. And so whereas for the past year, the Socialist Party have been down in the polls with making its special deal with the Catalan Nationalists, which a lot of people thought was uncalled for and unfair, now that it's negotiated a truce with ETA, the Socialists have risen in the polls. And for the first time, they're on the verge practically of an absolute majority in the opinion polls, but of course these things change and can change in the future. The strategy of the nationalists and even of ETA has always been that they realized they could not propose to get away with simply declaring the Basque country an independent state, though this has always been fundamentally their goal. And therefore, particularly with the breakup of the Soviet Union and the rise of self-determination, formation of independent republics out of Soviet republics, in the 1990s, the catchphrase became self-determination. That what they wanted was not independence, but self-determination for the Basque country. Catalan nationalists, some of the other regional nationalists, began to use the same kind of phrase. And so the present idea is self-determination and a special kind of new constitutional framework for the relationship between the Basque country and Spain. Critics say, well, this is simply de facto independence under another name. We're simply papering over the fact that the Basque state under this arrangement would really be an independent state. What they're really aiming for is something like the Irish deal of 1922. You remember how the time of troubles finally came to an end in Ireland. There was established the Irish Free State, which had a regular, autonomous, to all intents and purposes, virtually independent government for the island of Ireland, except for the northern counties of Ulster, and yet was not totally independent. It had a Commonwealth status under the British Empire, and according to the Irish Constitution, the new Constitution of the Irish State, the King of England was still the head of state of Ireland, and Ireland was still connected with the British Armed Forces, various aspects of the British Empire, so on. That arrangement lasted for 14 years. Then in the next Irish Constitution, the one that De Valera, interestingly the son of a Spanish emigrant, who married an Irish woman, brought in 1936. There was simply no mention at all of the British government, British crown, and 1936, the Republic of Ireland became fully independent. So that's really the kind of routing desired by Basque nationalists. How far they'll be able to go with it, we don't know.
You know, we started out, again, talking about this announcement by ETA, and certainly it was a big story and it made headlines all over. I think, though, in my reading about it, some people have said that, people who really follow Spanish politics have said that they maybe weren't real surprised in that there has been, since the Madrid bombings, a widespread revulsion at the very idea of violence as a political tool. And accompanying that, as far as ETA was concerned, some of the leadership over the past few years has been arrested. So I think that some people perhaps felt that ETA was not as strong an organization as it had been in the past, and it had been a couple of years since they had been involved in any violent action. So you add all that together, and my impression is that some people have said, well, that they really weren't all that surprised by the announcement by ETA that it was giving up the armed struggle. So having said all that, does that really mean that, I guess the question is, just how important, what in terms of Spain and Spanish politics, just how important was this? I mean, it seemed to have a great symbolic significance, but was there actually more than symbolic significance involved?
Well, there's more than symbolic significance involved because there is now in process a procedure of negotiation between the leaders of ETA and the nationalists in general, and the socialist government, which is going to lead to the attempted introduction of some kind of new constitutional arrangement for the Basque Country. So this really is something new. Now, as you suggest, a truce is not unprecedented. There was one in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew that ETA had become considerably weakened by 2004, though not non-existent. And the other factor that you mentioned also is important here, that the jihadi terrorism of such a tremendous terrorist scale had the effect, even for some of the would-be supporters or at least apologists for ETA, of delegitimizing terrorist activities, political violence, as a political strategy. So that psychologically and politically, you're absolutely correct. After 2004, it really was not quite the same for ETA. You put together the fact that on the one hand, they're weaker than they have been in the past. Second, that the political and psychological climate, even of their own society, does not support this kind of thing in the same way that it might have before 2004. And then, of course, the disposition of the socialist government to make a deal and give them at least part of what they're asking for. How far this is going, again, I repeat, we don't know. This is something that has been potentially in the works. It's just like many things in human life. It doesn't happen until it really happens. The Spanish Parliament, in fact, some months ago, had authorized the government to negotiate with ETA so long as the negotiation made clear that they would have to give up political violence and lay down their arms. So it's been known that this has been in the process for some time, but one can never be sure of the outcome. Even initially in terms of this first announcement until it actually happens. Hmm.
Well, in addition to this, and we're down to the point here, we really only have about a minute left, but in addition to this challenge that the government has on its hands of balancing the desire to have a Spain that hangs together as a nation and satisfying all these demands for regional autonomy, what other are there other important challenges that the government, Mr. Zapatero, has to face?
This is the number one challenge. Mm. As a democratic polity, the country is stable. The other major problems basically are the standard economic problems of all Western governments. Spain has been on a big roll for the past, as long as 10 years, since the conservatives came back in 1996. These last 10 years have been the fat years. The fat years are coming to an end. High oil prices. Spain imports all its virtually all of its energy, and the same kinds of problems one finds elsewhere. Spanish jobs now being moved by multinationals to Slovakia, to Poland, to countries that have much lower wage rates than Spain does. The country is going to have major problems of economic adjustment. Like the United States, it lives beyond its means. It has a significant trade imbalance. So from this point on, in fact, the first 2 years of Zapatero have been good years economically. He simply followed the conservative economic policy. But the fat years are coming to an end, and there will have to be some serious economic adjustments in Spain as well.
There we must stop because we've used our time. Our guest, Stanley Payne, is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin at Madison and specializes in modern history of Spain, Portugal, Italy. Professor Payne, thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me.